Diamond Heart 7, January 18th, 2009, PM session.
This afternoon we're going to start with the Who chant. And so, in particular this afternoon, let yourself sense the heart center. And let the sound come from that center. And you can, each who can be an invocation, an evocation really, of our true nature, where we are invoking and evoking what it is that we truly, truly love. So we can call to it with our who's. Who
Ooh.
So here we are together, probably in different places. But certainly our sense, Regina and I, is that there's a movement, that something's been activated. And it's the wanting, it's really allowing our wanting, which takes courage, sometimes lots of courage. It's the allowing of our wanting, not so much the getting, or not so much the what it is that we want, the content, but really just allowing that movement of the heart. That is the movement of a heart when it's unrestrained, unconstrained. And that's what was coming up here in the space, in the field, as people really spoke to what they want. Just letting that be. And it's that movement itself that matures the heart. It's allowing a natural movement, just like with any, you know, when you allow a child to get up and start walking, that natural movement is what strengthens the legs and matures the child to begin to recognize that he or she can start moving toward things, what they want, what they're curious about. So that freedom, that allowing the movement itself, allowing the wanting itself, matures us. And it begins to reveal what it is that our heart deeply, deeply loves and desires. And, you know, for the most part, it's the wanting itself that is the key. But sometimes the getting is a maturational step. The actually getting something that we want. I was thinking back when we were preparing this, I remembered probably one of the watershed moments, turning points in my life, but I have to back up a bit. When I was in grad school and met my friend Mary Lou, who we've been reunited with in this as a result of this group, but back in 69, I went off to grad school. It was probably my first real movement away from my family. And Mary Lou had an MGB convertible. And we used to ride around in it. And one day, three of us squeezed ourselves into this two-seater. There weren't seatbelt laws. Nobody cared. Top down. Blasting the latest Beatles album. I don't remember what it was. I think it was Abbey Road. There you go. She remembers. And three of us just singing at the top of our lungs, you know, driving down the road. We were going over to her house, singing those songs, top down, wind blowing through the hair. It was like one of the happiest days, I think, of my life. I had never had that kind of a sense of so much freedom. And I didn't understand then what it meant, what it represented to me, but from that point on, I wanted a convertible. And I was like, someday I'm going to buy me a convertible. So that was in 69. And every time it was time to buy a new car, I'd go and look at a convertible, and then I'd look, or I'd think about it, and then I'd get very practical and buy a Honda. I've had many Hondas. I have one now. But back then, you know, I was like, okay, I'm just going to get a Honda. And in 1994, after a number of Hondas, I don't know what it was. I was already in the work. I had all that spiritual superego. You don't really want the car. It's not the car. It's not the car. It's like, I want a convertible. And I went out and bought me a convertible. And I was happy. I was really, really happy with my car. And every time I'd turn on the ignition, this exuberance would just fill me. One of the first times I was riding over here to come to a group, I had the top down, and I guess I was speeding. And I got stopped, and I must have been just so exuberant. The policeman said, do you know how fast you were going? And I said, no. And he said, is this a new car? And I said, yes, it's my first convertible. He just smiled and he said, slow down. And I did. And there was just something, though, about that experience. It wasn't really the car, though I did enjoy it for many years, in spite of what everybody had said is, oh, you'll get the car and then it'll be empty. And no, I really enjoyed that car. But I really enjoyed it, I think, because of what it meant. It was the first time that I had allowed myself to go for something that I wanted and didn't talk myself out of it. Just let myself have it so that the maturation was feeling what it felt like to get something I wanted and to give it to myself. And what's also true is I don't care what I drive anymore. It just really doesn't matter. But I don't know if I would have gotten to that place other than intellectually had I not felt this complete fulfillment of something that I really wanted. So, you know, sometimes it is important, and it's that intelligence that what Regina was talking about this morning. It's like there's an intelligence that can arise to help us discriminate. Well, when do we just go get it, what we want? When do we really just put everything behind that? And when is it really completely fulfilling and satisfying enough to just feel the wanting and let that fill our souls? And the heart is a very subtle organ, as you're noticing. There's lots of subtlety as we feel the openness of our hearts. And so as we mature, what we want matures and refines itself. It refines and comes more and more in alignment with the subtlety of that center. You know, so like Regina was talking about this morning, in the beginning we want things. We want things that we can, you know, see and touch and feel the satisfaction of having. Or we want experiences. Or we want other people. We don't know we're turning them into things, but we want them. And over time, our wants start to refine so that we begin to see, oh, what I want is what I think I'm going to get from that thing. I want to feel joy, or I want to feel satisfaction, or I want to feel love, or I want to feel seen, or I want to feel valued. Whatever it is that we think the thing will bring us, including enlightenment, we can turn that into a thing. But it's that we want what we believe that will bring to our soul. And so our wanting begins to refine so that we start wanting the contact with ourselves, where we feel our own value, or we feel our own fullness, we feel the joy that we are. We feel happy. We feel proud of ourselves, and I don't mean in a prideful, egoic way. We're satisfied. We want that. We want to feel like we're okay, what Dean was talking about this morning. So we start to want some kind of fulfillment for ourselves, of our nature. We want our nature fulfilled. And our wanting can even refine itself to, I just want to enjoy what I have. That's an amazing experience, to actually drop into now, this moment, to look around at what I have, what I am, and feel that's what I want. I want me. I want my life as it is. I want what I have. It's enough. I'm enough. And each of those movements, that turning inward to experiencing something that's more and more intimate, more and more true, that we want ourselves, is bringing us closer and closer to our deepest heart's desire, which is that union with our nature, the beloved. We want what we love, and what we love is ourselves, our nature, reality, true nature. It's all the same. So I'm going to read you a story this afternoon. So you can get as comfortable as you would like to get for storytelling. Okay. And this is a story by Idris Shah, and it's from the book Caravan of Dreams. He was a Sufi master. And it's called A Teaching Story. And I'm going to read to you a little bit about what he means by a teaching story. Unlike the parable, and this isn't the story yet, okay? So it's just about the story. Unlike the parable, the meaning of the teaching story cannot be unraveled by ordinary intellectual methods alone. Its action is direct and certain upon the innermost part of the human being, an action incapable of manifestation by means of the emotional or intellectual apparatus. In other words, you can't try to figure it out. Okay? Don't think about the story. The closest we can come to describing its effect is to say that it connects with a part of the individual which cannot be reached by any other convention, and that it establishes in him or her a means of communication with a non-verbalized truth beyond the customary limitations of our familiar dimensions. Okay. So he says a lot more, but he's, what he's saying, what he's pointing to here, is that sometimes, really, the only place in our being that can understand certain truths is our heart. That we can listen from our heart, that there's a way that we can access something that's beyond really words. It's certainly beyond the mind, as we're seeing, particularly with joy, that joy is beyond the mind, and we can't grok it with our mind. So listen to this story kind of from your heart, unless you try to do something to make yourself listen from your heart. In which case, you will be back in your mind, trying to listen from your heart. So really, best thing to do is relax. Don't think about it. Just let the words come in. Enjoy the story. If you try to think about it from your mind, it's just going to sound like some silly story for children, and why are we taking this time to read it? So, the story is called The Magic Horse. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, there was a realm in which the people were exceedingly prosperous. All kinds of discoveries had been made by them in the growing of plants in the harvesting and preserving of fruits, and in making objects for sale to other countries, and in many other practical arts. Their ruler was unusually enlightened, and he encouraged new discoveries and activities because he knew of their advantages for his people. He had a son named Hoshyar, who was expert in using strange contrivances, and another called Tambal, a dreamer, who seemed interested only in things which were of little value in the eyes of the citizens. From time to time, the king, who was named King Mumkin, circulated announcements to this effect: "Let all those who have notable devices and useful artifacts present them to the palace for examination, so that they may be appropriately rewarded." Now there were two men in the country, an ironsmith and a woodworker, who were great rivals in most things, and each delighted in making strange contraptions. When they heard this announcement one day, they agreed to compete for an award, so that their relative merits could be decided once and for all by their sovereign and publicly recognized. Accordingly, the smith worked day and night on a mighty engine, employing a multitude of talented specialists and surrounding his workshop with high walls so that his devices and methods should not become known. At the same time, the woodworker took his simple tools and went into a forest, where after long and solitary reflection, he prepared his own masterpiece. News of the rivalry spread, and people thought that the smith must easily win, for his cunning works had been seen before. And while the woodworker's products were generally admired, they were only of occasional and undramatic use. When both were ready, the king received them in open court. The smith produced an immense metallic fish, which could, he said, swim in and under the water. It could carry large quantities of freight over the land. It could burrow into the earth, and it could even fly slowly through the air. At first, the court found it hard to believe that there could be such a wonder made by man. But when the smith and his assistants demonstrated it, the king was overjoyed and declared the smith amongst the most honored in the land, with a special rank and the title of benefactor of the community. Prince Hoshyar was placed in charge of the making of the wondrous fishes, and the services of this new device became available to all mankind. Everyone blessed the smith and Hoshyar, as well as the benign and sagacious monarch whom they loved so much. In the excitement, the self-effacing carpenter had been all but forgotten. Then, one day, someone said, "But what about the contest? Where is the entry of the woodworker? We all know him to be an ingenious man. Perhaps he has produced something useful." "How could anything be as useful as the wondrous fishes?" asked Hoshyar. And many of the courtiers and the people agreed with him. But one day, the king was bored. He had become accustomed to the novelty of the fishes and the reports of the wonders which they so regularly performed. He said, "Call the woodworker, for I would now like to see what he has made." The simple woodcarver came into the throne room carrying a parcel wrapped in coarse cloth. As the whole court craned forward to see what he had, he took off the covering to reveal a wooden horse. It was well enough carved, and it had some intricate patterning chiseled into it, as well as being decorated with colored paints. But it was only a mere plaything, snapped the king. "But father," said Prince Tambal, "let us ask the man what it is for." "Very well," said the king. "What is it for?" "Your majesty," stammered the woodcarver, "it is a magic horse. It does not look impressive, but it has, as it were, its own inner senses. Unlike the fish, which has to be directed, this horse can interpret the desires of the rider and carry him wherever he needs to go." "Such a stupidity is only fit for Tambal," murmured the chief minister at the king's elbow. "It cannot have any real advantage when measured against the wondrous fishes." The woodcarver was preparing sadly to depart when Tambal said, "Father, let me have the wooden horse." "All right," said the king, "give it to him. Take the woodcarver out, tie him to a tree somewhere, so he will realize that our time is valuable. Let him contemplate the prosperity which the wondrous fish has brought us, and perhaps after some time we shall let him go free to practice whatever he may have learned of real industriousness through true reflection." The woodcarver was taken away, and Prince Tambal left the court carrying the magic horse. Tambal took the horse into his quarters, where he discovered it had several knobs, cunningly concealed in the carved designs. When these were turned in a certain manner, the horse, together with anyone mounted on it, rose into the air and sped to whatever place was in the mind of the person who moved the knobs. In this way, day after day, Tambal flew to places which he had never visited before. By this process, he came to know a great many things, and he took the horse everywhere with him. One day, he met Hoshyar, who said to him, "Carrying a wooden horse is a fit occupation for someone such as you. As for me, I am working for the good of all, towards my heart's desire." Tambal thought, "I wish I knew what was the good of all. And I wish I could know what my heart's desire is." When he was next in his room, he sat upon the horse and thought, "I would like to find my heart's desire." At the same time, he moved some of the knobs on the horse's neck. Swifter than light, the horse rose into the air and carried the prince 1,000 days' ordinary journey away to a far kingdom ruled by a magician king. The king, whose name was Kahana, had a beautiful daughter called Precious Pearl, Duri Karima. In order to protect her, he had imprisoned her in a circling palace, which wheeled in the sky higher than any mortal could reach. As he was approaching the magic land, Tambal saw the glittering palace in the heavens and alighted there. The princess and the young horseman met and fell in love. "My father will never allow us to marry," she said, "for he had ordained that I become the wife of the son of another magician king who lives across the cold desert to the east of our homeland. He has vowed that when I am old enough, I shall cement the unity of the two kingdoms by this marriage. His will has never been successfully opposed." "I will go and try to reason with him," answered Tumball, as he mounted the magic horse again. But when he descended into the magic land, there were so many new and exciting things to see that he did not hurry to the palace. When at length he approached it, the drum at the gate, indicating the absence of the king, was already beating. "He has gone to visit his daughter in the Whirling Palace," said the passerby when Tumball asked him when the king might be back. "And he usually spends several hours at a time with her." Tumball went to a quiet place where he willed the horse to carry him to the king's own apartment. "I will approach him at his own home," he thought to himself, "for if I go to the Whirling Palace without his permission, he may be angry." He hid behind some curtains in the palace when he got there and lay down to sleep. Remember, he's a dreamer. Meanwhile, unable to keep her secret, the Princess Precious Pearl had confessed to her father that she had been visited by a man on a flying horse and that he wanted to marry her. Kahana was furious. He placed sentries around the Whirling Palace and returned to his own apartment to think things over. As soon as he entered his bedchamber, one of the tongueless magic servants guarding it pointed to the wooden horse lying in the corner. "Aha!" exclaimed the king. "Now I have him. Let us look at this horse and see what manner of thing it may be." As he and his servants were examining the horse, the prince managed to slip away and conceal himself in another part of the palace. After twisting the knobs and tapping the horse and generally trying to understand how it worked, the king was baffled. Take that thing away. It has no virtue now, even if it ever had any. It's just a trifle, fit for children." The horse was put in a store cupboard. Now King Kahana thought he should make arrangements for his daughter's wedding without delay, in case the fugitive might have other powers or devices with which to try to win her. So he called her to his own palace and sent a message to the other magician king, seeking that the prince who was to marry her be sent to claim his bride. There's more. We got more to this story. Meanwhile, Prince Tumball, escaping from the palace by night when some guards were asleep, decided that he must try to return to his own country. His quest for his heart's desire now seemed almost hopeless. "If it takes me the rest of my life," he said to himself, "I shall come back here, bringing troops to take this kingdom by force. I can only do that by convincing my father that I must have his help to attain my heart's desire." So saying, he set off. Never was a man worse equipped for such a journey. An alien traveling on foot without any kind of provisions, facing pitiless heat and freezing nights interspersed with sandstorms, he soon became hopelessly lost in the desert. Now in his delirium, Tumball started to blame himself, his father, the magician king, the woodcarver, even the princess and the magic horse itself. Sometimes he thought he saw water ahead, sometimes fair cities. Sometimes he felt elated, sometimes incomparably sad. Sometimes he even thought he had companions in his difficulties, but when he shook himself, he saw that he was quite alone. He seemed to have been traveling for an eternity. Suddenly, when he had given up and started again several times, he saw something directly in front of him. It looked like a mirage, a garden full of delicious fruits, sparkling and almost as it were, beckoning him towards them. Tomball did not at first take much notice of this, but soon, as he walked, he saw that he was indeed passing through such a garden. He gathered some of the fruits and tasted them cautiously. They were delicious. They took away his fear as well as his hunger and thirst. When he was full, he lay down in the shade of a huge and welcoming tree and fell asleep. When he woke up, he felt well enough, but something seemed wrong. Running to a nearby pool, he looked at his reflection in the water, and staring up at him was a horrible apparition. It had a long beard, carved horns, ears a foot long. He looked down at his hands. They were covered with fur. Was it a nightmare? He tried to wake himself, but all the pinching and pummeling had no effect. Now, almost bereft of his senses, beside himself with fear and horror, thrown into transports of screaming, racked with sobs, he threw himself on the ground. Whether I live or die, he thought, these accursed fruits have finally ruined me. Even with the greatest array of all time, conquest will not help me. Nobody would marry me now, much less the Princess Precious Pearl. And I cannot imagine the beast who would not be terrified at the sight of me, let alone my heart's desire. And he lost consciousness. When he awoke again, it was dark, and a light was approaching through the groves of silent trees. Fear and hope struggled in him. As it came closer, he saw that the light was from a lamp enclosed in a brilliant, star-like shape, and it was carried by a bearded man who walked in a pool of brightness which it cast around him. The man saw him. "My son," he said, "you have been affected by the influence of this place. If I had not come past, you would have remained just another beast of this enchanted grove, for there are many more like you. But I can help." Tomball wondered whether this man was a fiend in disguise, perhaps the very owner of the evil trees, but as his sense came back, he realized that he had nothing to lose. "Help me, Father," he said to the sage. "If you really want your heart's desire," said the other man, "you have only to fix this desire firmly in your mind, not thinking of the fruit. You then have to take up some of the dried fruits, not the fresh, delicious ones lying at the foot of these trees, and eat them, then follow your destiny." So saying, he walked away. While the sage's light disappeared into the darkness, Tomball saw that the moon was rising, and in his rays he could see that indeed there were piles of dried fruits under every tree. He gathered some and ate them as quickly as he could. Slowly, as he watched, the fur disappeared from his hands and arms, The horns first shrank, then vanished. The beard fell away. He was himself again. By now it was first light, and in the dawn he heard the tinkling of camel bells. A procession was coming through the enchanted forest. It was undoubtedly the cavalcade of some important personage on a long journey. As Tomble stood there, two outriders detached themselves from the glittering escort and galloped up to him. "In the name of the prince, our lord, we demand some of your fruit. His celestial highness is thirsty, and he has indicated a desire for some of these strange apricots," said an officer. Still, Tomble did not move. Such was his numbed condition after his recent experiences. Now the prince himself came down from his palanquin and said, "I am Jatakaraja, son of the magician king of the East. Here is a bag of gold, Oaf. I'm having some of your fruit because I'm desirous of it, and I'm in a hurry, hastening to claim my bride, Princess Precious Pearl, daughter of Kahana, magician king of the West." At these words, Tomble's heart turned over. But realizing that this must be his destiny, which the sage had told him to follow, he offered the prince as much fruit as he could eat. When he had eaten, the prince began to fall asleep. And as he did, so horns, fur, and huge ears started to grow out of him. The soldiers shook him, and the prince began to behave in a strange way. He claimed that he was normal and they were deformed. The counselors who accompanied the party restrained the prince and held a hurried debate. Tomble claimed that all would have been well if the prince had not fallen asleep. Eventually, it was decided to put Tomble in the palanquin to play the part of the prince. The horned Jatakaraja, I'm not exactly sure if that's the right pronunciation, was tied to a horse with a veil thrown over his face, disguised as a serving woman. "He may recover his wits eventually," said the counselors, "and in any case, he is still our prince. Tomble shall marry the girl, then as soon as possible, we shall carry them all back to our own country for our king to unravel the problem." Tomble, biding his time and following his destiny, agreed to his own part in the masquerade. When the party arrived at the capital of the West, the king himself came out to meet them. Tomble was taken to the princess as her bridegroom, and she was so astonished that she nearly fainted. But Tomble managed to whisper to her rapidly what had happened, and they were duly married amid great jubilation. In the meantime, the horned prince had recovered his wits, but not his human form. And his escort still kept him under cover. As soon as the feasting was over, the chief of the horned prince's party, who had been keeping Tomble and the princess under very close watch, presented himself to the court. He said, "O just and glorious monarch, fountain of wisdom, the time has come, according to the pronouncements of our astrologers and soothsayers, to conduct the bridal pair back to our own land so that they may be established in their new home under the most felicitous circumstances and influences." The princess turned to Tomble in alarm, for she knew that the one whose name I can't pronounce, would claim her as soon as they were in the open road and make an end of Tomble in the bargain. Tomble whispered to her fear nothing. We must act as best we can, following our destiny. Agree to go, making only the condition that you will not travel without the wooden horse. At first, the magician king was annoyed at this foible of his daughter's. He realized that she wanted the horse because it connected her with her first suitor. But the chief minister of the horned prince said, "Majesty, I cannot see that there is anything worse than a whim for a toy, such as any young girl might have. I hope that you will allow her to have her plaything so that we may make haste homeward." So the magician king agreed, and soon the cavalcade was resplendently on its way. After the king's escort had withdrawn, and before the time of the first night halt, the hideous prince threw off his veil and cried out to Tomball, "Miserable author of my misfortunes, I now intend to bind you hand and foot, to take you captive back to my own land. If when we arrive there you do not tell me how to remove this enchantment, I will have you flayed alive, inch by inch. Now give me the princess' precious pearl." Tomball ran to the princess, and in front of the astonished party, rose into the sky on the wooden horse with Princess Precious Pearl mounted behind him. Within a matter of minutes, the couple alighted at the palace of King Mumpkin. They related everything that had happened to him, to them, and the king was almost overcome with delight at their safe return. He at once gave orders for the hapless woodcarver to be released, recompensed, and applauded by the entire populace. When the king was gathered to his fathers, Princess Precious Pearl and Prince Tomball succeeded him. Prince Hosher was quite pleased too, because he was still entranced by the wondrous fish. "I am glad for your own sakes if you are happy," he used to say to them. "But for my own part, nothing is more rewarding than concerning myself with the wondrous fish." And this history is the origin of a strange saying current among the people of that land, yet whose beginnings have now been forgotten. The saying is, "Those who want fish can achieve much through fish, and those who do not know their heart's desire may first have to hear the story of the wooden horse." So the heart is a very sensitive organ. It's our truth rudder. The heart knows what it loves, and it wants what it loves, and it loves what it wants. Even when our minds don't know yet what our heart's desire is. You know, we've talked a lot these last two weekends about how the heart and the mind really get disconnected from each other over the course of our conditioning. And so what happens is that the true heart's desire gets dispersed. It gets shattered so that it kind of disperses out into many, many wants. But all of those wants, everything that we think we want or know we want in the moment that we want it, all of our wants are reflections of the one true heart's desire, that deep desire for truth. What Regina was saying this morning, the deep desire to know our nature, to know ourselves, to have ourselves. That's our deepest desire. So we follow these many reflections, and that's why it's important sometimes to have what we want, to get the shed that we want, or to get the convertible that we want, to go ahead and get it. Because it is a reflection of something true. And the more that we can allow that movement, the closer and closer we come to our heart's desire. So we want to take some time this afternoon to have that kind of an exploration. And it doesn't matter where you are in relation to this teaching. If you know your heart's desire, and I don't mean like something like, I know I want enlightenment. Do you know what enlightenment is? Do you know what that means? Do you know what that feels like? That's your heart's desire. It's like, what's that? What is that? What is it that you really, really want? Not what do you think you want. Not what you should want. Not what others, somebody else has said they wanted and it sounded good to you. This is such an intimate exploration. It's turning our attention completely inward to that very delicate heart sensor to allow the open inquiry and feeling into what is my heart's desire. We all want the Princess Precious Pearl. That's our heart's desire. And like Tomble, we go through many ups and downs, and things seem like hopeless or frightening or, you know, difficult challenges. But it's that staying true that will take us home. So we're going to do an exploration in a monologue this afternoon. So three people. So for 15 minutes each, but no feedback. Take 15 minutes to explore this question of just what's my heart's desire? What is my true love? What do I want more than anything else? And this needs, you know, it needs to be honest. You need to be honest with yourself. Forget the story now. Forget the teachings. Forget everything you've ever heard. And just be with yourself and see if you can simply kind of follow what comes out. Just let it come out in the moment, even if it surprises you. So let yourself keep asking the question, what is my heart's desire? What do I really, really love? What do I really, really want? More than anything. And it doesn't matter what the answer is. Just remember that. It's the allowing the question, allowing yourself to explore in this way. So it's a heartfelt, intimate exploration. And then at the end of the monologue, so that'll be 45 minutes, take, let's just take 5 minutes more, just amongst yourselves, to talk about what was that like to hear each other. What was it like? Maybe you need 10 minutes. It's probably more. Yeah, I don't want to rush it. What was that like to just be witness to each other's exploration? And were you affected by that in any way? Just simply by being witness to, it's not about, oh, that was really great what you said. No evaluation, no really comment on each other's heart's desire. But more, what was the effect of being doing that inquiry together and supporting each other in this search for truth, okay? So we'll come back at, how about if we come back to our seats at 5 after. So at 5 o'clock, ring the Adha bell, and that tells you to start, you know, finishing up your inquiry and heading back to your seats. So what did you find? What kind of discoveries? Mm-hmm. And even if you don't stand up to say something, just really let whatever you discovered sink in. Just hold it real close to your heart, let it sink in, let it touch you and affect you. Because that's what's actually most important about this particular inquiry, this discovery.
Judith, whoops. Yeah.
Guess keep talking.
Okay.
There you go.
I was going to share this morning, so I guess I'll share it now.
I think it needs to be up a little more. There you go.
Okay.
Okay.
Better. It seems like each weekend, whatever's up for me seems to be answered. I don't know whether you organized it this way or whether it's just me. But what's been really a query for me for maybe a month or two, has been this idea of really wanting something and not going for it. Uh-huh. And it's been up a little bit, came up in our small group. Someone else seemed to have the same query. And you know, I've really sort of set my whole life up to continue doing my art. I've got a part-time job, I've got time, I've got it all organized, and I'm not doing it.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's a fear of wanting it too much, I guess. This idea of really wanting something, allowing yourself to wanting, that's, I think, useful for me. But what I also had this thought during this last inquiry that the result of being an artist and being out in the world and being out and doing it is possibly two things. Really humiliating, because people mm-hmm. might really, you know, not like it and say bad things about it and be very hurt, and terribly disappointing. And I think part of the reason I haven't gone for it is I think I didn't get before this work that I could handle that. And mm-hmm. just to share that I feel like now if I'm humiliated or incredibly disappointed, I actually might be able to sit with that instead of being destroyed by it.
That is really an amazing step.
Yeah, I just sort of
got
that.
Because it opens up so many possibilities for
right.
you. Judith, that's lovely.
Yeah, and you know, and just the idea of sitting with that is not like fun. It's like root canal sort of thing, you know, but but I got those too, so.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Thank you. Okay, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I wanted to say that doing that last exercise, you had formulated the question a couple different ways. And when I was trying to work with what do I want more than anything else, I found that a difficult formulation, but then when I thought about my heart's desire, suddenly it got very much easier. And my heart just said, geez, let me out. You know, I will just go and love everything. That's what I'm waiting for. Just anytime you want to do it, just let me out. I'm ready to go. You know, it's like, yeah. So, yeah, I didn't know that, really. So it was really, it was helpful to see that. This whole day has been tremendously eye-opening. I've just been sort of amazed at what I didn't know about joy, what I didn't know about wanting, how many ideas I had that just don't seem to be true. It's been everything from incredibly sad to see what I haven't let myself have in terms of joy and wanting, and also just really exciting. I feel really excited to look at this. This is, feels like a whole new door open for me, and so I'm really feeling gratitude about that and excitement and a little trepidation about going back home and to the world and work and all that. So feeling so comfortable here with this, with everyone. So I don't know if I really have a question, but just...
Well, so that could be there, right there. You could start getting curious about why is what you call the world different from this? Because what's opened up for you is your heart, and that's what you're going to take home and take to work.
I'm scared to do that.
So that's okay. Remember Tomball? How scared he was? Yeah, that's okay. It's all right to feel fear. And you can be open to that and feel your fear. It doesn't have to stop you. It's just another, you know, it's a part of the experience.
Yeah.
It's okay to feel that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What are you feeling right now?
I was feeling the fear a little bit. Mm-hmm. And feeling a little bit, I felt sort of met by what you said. And I was just trying to feel into what it's like to be afraid and to still have my heart open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, to remember in the story, it's like what the sage said to Tomball is, don't, you know, set your mind on your heart's desire and then just follow that. So if you set your mind on your heart's desire, I want to love everything. I want to just love. You don't have to figure it out. Just say, you know, it's kind of like the mind including the heart. Just set your mind on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark, one thing I noticed myself saying that was my heart's desire was to follow my heart's desire. And I think there's some truth to that, but I...
That's better, yeah.
But I don't really know what it is, so... and that's okay. I'm watching the feeling. I'm a little conflicted with the Buddhist teachings.
Yes.
Desire causing suffering. I could use some clarification on that.
Can you just, I can't quite, so you're it brings up the Buddhist teaching about?
Desire causes suffering.
Right, Right.
So, and to make it personal, I've been focusing more on my path and trying to keep those things in perspective. And that's had an effect.
Somebody's...
That's mine. Would you mind...
I think God's calling you. Saying something like, all teachings lead to one truth.
It was the alarm clock.
What was that?
It wasn't the phone, it was the alarm clock.
Wake up. All paths, if they are true, lead to one truth, one teaching. That's right. That's right. So it can get confusing in the mind when we think about desire as one of the poisons. And it's, you know, when we talk about it that way, we're talking about desire from the egoic, just from the whole egoic perspective. And when we work here with different obscurations, we're recognizing and pointing to there's something about wanting that has gotten distorted, and it becomes about desire and greed, and I want that, I want that, I want that, I need that. And it's, you know, we have to start where we are, and we start unraveling that, and at the same time, always being, the difference is always bringing in the curiosity to see, well, what is it about this wanting? Is this what I really, really want? And as long as you're asking that question, it is going to take you to that place where there is no split. There's nothing separating you from truth, from nature. And it's not a subject wanting an object. It's simply love loving the beloved. And you can't get there if that's not where you are. You can't just make yourself jump over all the different confusions that have obscured that truth growing up and just living in this world. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It feels a bit like as soon as we identify what it is that we want, that we're starting to look outside of ourselves, outside of that feeling and onto the objects.
That's right.
Which is then the distortion.
Exactly. There you go. So it's fine to want that. And then you come back. What is it that that's giving me? Or what do I think that's bringing me? And then see if the coming back to yourself, you know, brings you closer to something true.
Thank you.
Thank you. Here and there. Okay.
I wanted to share with you that 2 years ago, I think I was in the same chair, and it was my first introductory weekend to Diamond Heart. And it was the first talk I'd ever heard. And you were the one giving it. And you ended it with a poem, with a Rumi poem of, it was four lines about a rose.
Oh.
And
Hafiz.
Oh, it was a Hafiz, yeah, it was Hafiz. And I mean, I remember hearing that poem as you read it and being so touched by it and crying and thinking to myself, I hope she doesn't read it again. And then you looked what seemed like straight at me or in this direction, and you said, I'm going to read it again. And yeah, and I feel a lot of joy to have gotten your teaching, and I really appreciate your presence and wish you the best wherever you're going.
Thank you so much, Sharif. Yeah. Yes, Daniel.
Daniel, I was when we shared as a group after the thing. I was curious about everyone else's experience too, but it seemed I was really aware of this kind of a tension, like each of us was like struggle. There was like a struggle, like a birthing sort of a thing that wanted to happen because we were trying to define it, like you said, when we define it, when we try to define it, try to make it into something our brain can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this yearning, almost like an ache, and it's right there. What we want, you know, what we want is right there. But it's like a fear of stating it clearly, or and it's interesting about the referring back to the first group, because I had a memory of my first group too when Hamid was sharing, and I got really excited, and I just said, I want what I had when I'd wake up in the morning and go, what, I'm so glad that I'm done sleeping, that sleep thing is done, now I can, what's happening next? I wonder what's happening next.
Mm-hmm.
And how systematically I've gotten put, not victimized, but I learned to be closed to that juice of life, and afraid that if I put it out there, I'll disappear. Or I know I'm going all over the place. I'm excited about this weekend, though. It was just very exciting about the wanting and becoming aware of how most of my experience of wanting is this corralled sense in my gut that's not being allowed to go out, when really I know the experience of really wanting is just this explosion out of my out of my heart. But my brain isn't there, and it doesn't want me to go there without it.
That's right.
But I want to go there without it.
Maybe the truer thing is it wants to lead the way and it can't, but it can come with.
It can come with.
It can come with. There's room.
We need a cook, right?
At least. Right. Yeah, nothing gets left behind. That's the important thing to remember on this journey of the heart. Nothing gets left behind. It's that we open up to our full potential.
The big fear is not having the, or that the mind has, is that I'm not going to be able to function, even though I've noticed that when I'm closest to being like that, things get done much quicker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Thank you.
And I'm going to miss you too.
Thank you. I miss you too. Yes.
I'm Carolyn. And I just think it's so lovely that your final teaching with us is art. Because you have always spoken directly to my heart. Even the quality of your voice speaks to my heart. And your wonderful expressive face. So I just want to thank you for bringing us to this point. And may you go with a lot of love.
Thank you so much. Mary Beth, and then Ezra.
Mary. So my heart's desire has been very constrained over the years, and I recognize that in a whole new way today. And I think, I know as you were reading the story, you know, it was like, I didn't know, but I knew that this was my heart's desire, was to be here today, at this moment, listening to the story that you read with such love and compassion. And like Carolyn said, it's just your voice. And to truly take in the last moment of being in this space together with you and this particular group at this particular time in history, I recognize that's my heart's desire. So, and with that comes much gratitude for your presence and the presence of the whole group. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's quite a moment in time, isn't it?
Hi, I just had a quick question. You just said, while Daniel was speaking, you said that your heart and your desire and your love wants to lead the way, but it can't.
What was it your...
You said to Daniel that your desire and your heart wants to lead the way, but it can't?
No, I said your mind to lead the way, but it can't.
Okay.
But it can come along.
Gotcha.
The heart is the rudder. And that's what leads the way. Yeah? Make sense?
Yeah. Quick question.
Sure.
I've always thought that if I could just relax and intuit my heart, then everything would be easier. And that's and for me, there's been a lot of doubt, I guess, in my mind of what action to take in intuiting that.
Yes.
That heart desire. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a big challenge for me.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any practice that you found helpful besides sitting?
Well, we have a whole retreat coming up that is actually... You know, going to speak to some of that very personally. I think that's the best answer right now. I think the retreat, you know, Regina and I were just musing about how, you know, certainly we didn't plan this because I didn't know I was leaving at this point when we planned this teaching. But, you know, the intelligence of the way things unfold, and we were saying how this, that we could just feel the movement of the group toward the next teaching, which is the teaching of the retreat. And so it will address some of those issues, some of the ways that the mind interferes with our knowing, our real knowing. Yeah. Okay. So two more, and then we'll see. Oop. Oh, it was Regina. Okay, three more.
Mm-hmm. Regula. Yeah, I wanted to thank you very much for teaching, and I want to see you again here. So I hope this wish will be fulfilled.
Mm.
I especially I resonated with you around the comedy about the seriousness. We in Switzerland, we had a 5-minute show every Saturday on comedy because you could only have 5 minutes of joy and fun a week. So I was jealous of you that you had a whole, you know, TV, 2 hours or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very rich weekend, I feel, profound feelings about joy.
Mm-hmm.
And about what my heart wants. You know, something was so powerful in this time together for me that I could say a heart wish I had for many, many years. And I was too scared to actually say it to people, especially to my ex-husband and even to my sons. And I said it. And it was very freeing.
Here, you
yes,
said
I said it in the group. Mm. And it was very freeing. And even my heart, I just really directly spoke from my heart. It was really there and really wanted to be heard and really wanted to come out. And then when I said it later, I thought, you know, even if I cannot go there or what I wanted, but just the power of having it said.
That's right.
And having, you know, giving it a voice.
That's right.
Was very powerful. Mm-hmm. And yes,
thank you.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to speak to one of the ways that the mind interferes for me. Mm. And you know, there was a question a bit earlier about the desire as an obstacle to realization in Eastern perspective. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me, I was reading Nisargadatta Maharaj, and there was one sentence that really jumped at me. Because within that perspective, it said, shallow desires can be transcended by introspection and meditation, but deep-rooted one needs to be fulfilled. Uh-huh. And their fruit, bitter or sweet, tasted. And that's what you brought in with the story about the convertible. Mm-hmm. You know, by the way, in 1994, I also bought my one and only convertible.
Lovely.
So it spoke to me directly. And I noticed the tendency of the mind to go, well, I know that if I fulfill that desire, it will only be another step. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I'm going to go there directly. Why should I spend energy fulfilling that desire? Mm-hmm. Where I know it's going to bring me to the same place. And in doing that, the mind is colluding with the superego and all kind of other voices telling me I shouldn't have the desires that I have.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And this bypass that sounds so logical to make is actually an obstacle, because there's always this thing that I always wanted that convertible. Mm-hmm. When I've had it, it's done, over, we can, you know,
move on.
Mm-hmm. But if it's not done, it's always like, oh, well, this thing, mm-hmm. maybe.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it is heart's desire.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you want to spend the rest of your life with marvelous fish. I mean, it's possible that would be it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. After we're all done. We're not quite done yet. But we'll do a dab. Yeah. Did you want to say something?
So this moment is a beautiful one. And it always seems difficult when changes come about, where people that you're connected with in your heart are going in a different direction for a while. And it's not that I will never see Roseanne. We teach together in different ways. But it seems so important in this group that you have a way of making closure and a way of making closure for you also. So I wonder, is there anything you want to say back to them at this moment?
Mm. Yes. Oh, for one, I really hope our paths cross again. And if I haven't learned anything in this past year and a half, it's that you never know. And you don't know how long you're going to live, and you don't know what turns your life will take. But if right now what I feel is that if I'm blessed, we'll meet again. And in this group, because there's something that's been, when I was watching you all come back after the exercise, I just felt this wave of love, and I realized how much I have loved being a part of this group and come to know you and appreciate each one of you. It's been really very, very rich experience for me. So I feel like I'm leaving in the middle, not even the middle of the story, and I want to see how it goes. I want to see what happens next. So I'm trusting that somehow that'll happen. And I've just gotten so much from this experience, so I really appreciate having this time together. So thank you. Thank you.
So I think, too, if that's a good thing that you're all doing. Let's do it all together. You know the term namaste? I salute the divine in you. Well, let's do that. You can do it for them, and you can do it for her. Let's all say namaste as you make that pranam in honor of the presence that we are. She's not really going anywhere, you know. Are moving through space. So let's do namaste.
Namaste. So let's end with a little tune. I think this just feels right. I know it's late, but it feels important. So again, just let yourself feel where you are. And we can all just appreciate the moment. Okay. Mozart, by the way. Thank you. So may you go in peace and love and joy. And Kelly needs some adab people, so don't everybody go. How many people do you need, Kelly?
Sorry for the anticlimactic note. we just need one for Thursday and one for Friday. So if anyone could come in the back and sign up, I'd really appreciate it.
Are you good for this afternoon?
Yes. Okay.